Taxation number 22114, Reel 2.
Cartel Reel 2.
We were 7 or 8 hours on the mole. That was the name of it, mole. And this destroyer came in. We were firing when it came in. And he put in alongside a wreck. The wreck was sunk just off the mole, and he had to pull in alongside it. So we scrambled over this wreck, and he shouted for to jump. When the boat was going down, he said, "If you jump when the boat's coming out, you'll the ankles in." We said, "Jump when I tell you." There's a lot of Frenchmen, by the way, there. So as the destroyer started to go down with the swell of the sea, we jumped, and French soldiers and they fell at soon, and we all landed and kept jumping every time. And they were still firing, taking some targets inland. And then as soon as we were full, it pulled out. And
do you know the name of the ship?
No, I can't remember. I wish I could. And I did remember it for the first 2 or 3 years, and then it faded. And we set off, and we'd been out about 2 or 3 miles when the usual German aircraft come over again. And when I started circling, I thought, they got the pom-poms, and some of the lads had manned the brain guns up. And they drove him off. So and then we set off and we finished up in Dover. From Dover we were put onto trains, given a cup of tea and some biscuits, and given a card which was to fill in and score off what either we were all right, we were wounded, or we got back and all like that. And these women then, I think they were at WVS, Women's Voluntary Service, I think they call them. And you give it to them back, and they posted it off. And then we set up by train, and I finished up in a place called Tenby in Wales, South Wales.
What condition were you in?
I wasn't in too bad a condition at all. Like, in fact, I got my rifle. I still had my rifle, and 50... a bandolier of 50. I still had that. A lot of people hadn't, but you see, the 3rd British Infantry Division had been holding the line while all these other people had been going there. Somebody had to hold the line while all these other evacuation were going off, you see. Then when that happened, there were hardly any defence left. When we got the order for us to make a run for it, there was hardly only token resistance left then.
When they blew the bridge up,
yeah,
did your Bren carrier go up with the bridge?
It must have been right near about, because it was only just got over the bridge. I don't know what happened to it, because they blew the bridge after we'd set off walking, you see.
When you were in France at Fretton, how did you get on with the French population?
Very well indeed. Very well indeed. In fact, just over a fortnight ago, I went back to Fretton, and went to see an old laddie who used to go in Estaminet. He was as old as my father, actually. He'd been a pilot in the 1418 war. They called him Georges Le Grand and his wife, and they looked after me and another lad as if they were their sons. And I went back a fortnight ago, and I went to see, and I found his grave in Fretton churchyard, and I took with me 17 crosses and a wreath, and I put the cross in. We searched that until we found that grave of George, and we put this cross on, and we also took a video of it. And yes, the natives, they were very good to us, no doubt about that.
So you said you went to Tenby?
Yes.
What happened at Tenby?
When we arrived at Tenby, we were put in the territorial centre, and the following day, everybody were dog tired. They don't really had any sleep, you see. And I ought to have mentioned that. Everybody was so dog tired and weary, and digging and what have you. And anyway, the following day, the colonel he came out of the territorial centre and he put us all on parade and he says, I'm afraid we've lost the war, gentlemen. Dunkirk's about to fall. I looked at the papers and it said that imminent fall and there's nothing left practically. That would be about the 3rd. I think that was about the 3rd of May then. The 3rd of June.
Did he say we'd lost the war?
Yes, he thought we'd lost the war. He said, I'm afraid, gentlemen, looks as if we've lost the war. I remember him saying that. There was a lot of depression on at that time, I know. It looked very bad. It looked really bad at that time.
Who was this man who said this?
It was a colonel, I don't know. I don't know him from Adam. I never saw him anymore. We were there 2 or 3 days, and then we were told to go to pull back to his units at a place called Somerset. I forgot the name of the place. In Somerset, anyway. And then when we got back there, the battalion, what were left of the battalion, were assembled there, and then they sent us all on leave. During that time, I think the King came and visited. While I was on holiday, I think King George VI came and visited the battalion in Somerset. And that's actually the end of Dunkirk, as I can think about.
So what happened to you in England?
Well, in England, when we got back, we made the brigade again and rebuilt reinforcements and all like that. And then we started training for going back. Montgomery, who was our divisional commander at that time, he said that we were last out and we'd be the first back, and he kept to that. So we did a series of stunts, what they call stunts. We looked fine in Scotland, did quite a number of exercises. We're way up north of England, of Scotland, and doing exercises. We're in Folkestone, during the time it was shelling the place from Calais. We did 2 tours down there.
What was the shelling of Folkestone like?
Well, all the front had been smashed. There was nobody allowed down there. Only the troops that were all manning fortification down at front, and all the front had been smashed up, and we did 2 tours down there at Folkestone, and we moved all over the country at one time.
Were there many casualties being caused at Folkestone?
I don't know about how many were. We also had the role, as there were a regular division, we also had the role of defending the southern coastline. What weapons had been left was given to the 3rd British Infantry Division, and we were then put into old coaches. Some of them had got the old-fashioned coach which had to do it every few seats.
Do you mean railway coaches?
No, coaches, buses. And we were looking at that, and we used to run up and down from patrolling, it were, down the south coast from Brighton down into Devon and all that, patrolling, actually, all the time. And we did get one alert when he said that the German invasion forces set off. And in fact, the whole country was on the alert, but nothing happened, and they were stood down.
Did you think the Germans would invade at that time?
Yes, yes. And that immediately followed the start all the bombing, then the bombing of London, Sheffield, Manchester, Liverpool, Coventry, all these other civilian attacked.
Did you at that time think that you could handle the Germans if they invaded?
I think if they'd invaded in force, I don't think we would have been able to hold them. I don't think so. We'd only got really one division, and all others were being trained ready, you know, they hadn't got the equipment anyway. I think he missed a golden opportunity if it had come in. And if they land at Parachutes and what have you, I'm afraid we were in difficulties.
Were you listening to the wireless at this time?
Yeah, well, we had listened to doing, you know, there were all kinds of slogans about wolves have ears and all like that. We weren't allowed to discuss military anyway, we just get away from anything like that. There were all kinds of slogans not to talk in public, where you were going or what you were doing. Anyway, the letters were censored as well. All the letters were censored and blue lines were not put this in, can't put that in.
Did you listen to any broadcasts by Churchill?
Yes, and I think he rallied the country. There's no doubt about that, man rallied the country. He was very forward looking. He'd already warned the country that the Germans were rearming, and rearming fast. We was disarming, under the Geneva Convention, they were supposed to be disarming. Germany was rearming, and as fast as they could, really. And Churchill told the government and the country that this was happening. And I think he was the man for the job at that particular time. And he was a good orator. He rallied the people. I had a big admiration for Churchill, especially at that particular time.
What do you remember happening next?
Well, we were taken on to Salisbury Plains on one occasion and started training for desert warfare. And it was imminent. Things weren't going very well in the Middle East. And they decided that the 3rd British Infantry Division were going to go out there as well to try and stem the Germans' advances in the Middle East. But anyway, we were taken off that. And I think the 51st Islanders took that job over. And another one was at, I think it was Dieppe. We were training for that job, and apparently the Canadian Prime Minister, I think they called him, I'm not sure if they called him Menzies or something like that, he asked for the Canadian division to do that job. And he got a rough passage when they landed. We went and stood by in the New Forest to be called in case they required reinforcements, but it was aborted. And we were pulled out. There were quite a lot of Canadians and commandos that got killed there.
Did you have the same job with the battalion now?
No, I'd left the carriers, and what did I do? I went on to police force. I went on to police, regimental police force for a spell. Then I did a bit of stretcher bearing, because they all had to have these things, you know, even police down and what have you, they all had to have these. Little groups, And then they started training seriously for D-Day. We did quite a number of landings right up in north of Scotland, and also on the west coast of Scotland, the Deer Islands, we used to practice on, you know, doing full-scale assault landings using live ammunition. Then when it became close to D-Day being launched, we were moved down south and into sealed camps, about 8 miles out of Portsmouth. I think they call it Dunmield or something like that. It was a big wood, and we were all put into there, and it was all barbed wired off and patrolled. And we were in there for about 10 or 12 days. And there were all kinds of messages coming through for groups to be attend this and attend that and all like that. And then the day when D-Day arrived, we were put into trucks and taken down to Portsmouth. Now, this happened twice. We set off and we got onto the assault landing craft. And then we'd been on about 12 and all the ones had been cancelled, and we were put back on the trucks and taken back into the SEAL camps. It later turned out that it had been aborted due to the bad weather in the channel. Then the following day, it was the same procedure, back onto the boats, but this time it was for real. And we set off. It was around about eventide. You could see all the ships and all like that, especially around the Isle of Wight. And there were thousands, hundreds and hundreds of boats there. We sailed through them and set off. And the following morning, during the night, there had been a certain time put by that you could only see maps of where you were going to land. And it might have been about 12 o'clock at night when they opened these maps to find out exactly where they were going to land in France. And then, of course, they found out where they were, not far from Caen. And everybody were alerted to where they were going then. They'd already had good briefings because they'd had aerial photographs and shots from sea of the way we were exactly going to land. And I remember passing the battleships, two battleships.
Warspite
and the guns are outside.
The Ramillies?
Ramillies, aye. They were the two. And they were firing. There were quite a number, but we recognised them too. And we landed in a place called Queen Beach at Lyon-sur-Mer. As the ramps went down and we run off, we carried bicycles. And these bicycles were on pegs. And as we come up, we'd all been told to get dressed, ready to land. And as the ramps went down, we grabbed these here bicycles and run off, and with what they call a decent landing. I think at about 18 inches of water, no more. Someone unfortunately had been landing 3 or 4 foot of water, but we didn't. And as we landed, there were a German, and he got his hands on his head, but nobody bothered with him. They just kept running forward, you know, into position. They'd been told where to go and stop there. So we got clear of the beach, and then we came under mortar fire. And then there was a burst of machine gun fire, and it must have put the mortar out because they never fired no more. Well, I guess in the village of Lyon-sur-Mer, commandos were there and they were taking the German snipers on. But our job was to ignore them. We got to get up to this assembly area. And when we got up to this assembly area, we dug in for a couple of 3 hours. And then we were told to move on again. And we moved on to a place called, I think it was like St. Anthony or something like that. And we dug in there. And from that position, we watched the 6th Airborne, all the supplies that came over. They'd already landed, them lads, and they were up down the bridge here, which they'd just captured. And we saw all their supplies and some more parachute, but they were all landing about 6 or 7 o'clock at night, that way. The following morning, we were going to attack, and we attacked.
Is this Lameno?
Attack Limensel. And I mean, we captured that, but along with the Royal Ulster Rifles.
What was the attack on this village like?
We didn't lose too many. We just lost the odd few, but we did come under fire. What happened was that a British unit had mistaken us for the enemy, and they opened up on us. And we in our turn thought that the Germans had infiltrated to our rear, so we turned round to recapture this line of communications. And then they found out it was a British unit that had opened up on us. Anyway, the following morning we advanced towards Limensel, and there were quite a few casualties. But the Limensel actually was a farm and two or three buildings. The main attack was to be on a place called Cam's Wood. Now, Cam's Wood was about 1,000 yards from Limensel. And the Ulster Rifles were put into the attack. They got into the wood, but had a hell of a lot of casualties. And they were in difficulties. So the CO, our CO, the KOSB CO, asked the brigadier for permission to put an attack in on the flank of Cam's Wood. And the brigadier agreed. So we went across this wheat field, 5 yards apart, until we got into the wood, and then we went in with the bayonet. And we cleared the Germans out through the bayonet. The Ulster had really had a bad time. I remember just in about 10 square yards, there was 8 Germans and 12 Ulster riflemen, all dead. Someone they must have entered their rifles into each other. They're all in 10 square yards. Anyway, we charged through the wood with bayonets and all like that. And the Germans were out at the other end. We captured quite a few prisoners. Then he opened up with his mortars and his artillery, and he turned Cam's Wood. Well, the trees were laid about and twigs and what have you, and it was real smashed up. The chateau inside the buildings had just been knocked down altogether. And we lost quite a bit. The platoon I was with, which was now 9th Platoon in D Company, a lad, only about 3 yards, he were killed. And I heard him cry out, and so I met the ground. And then I could see two or three more out of the corner of my eye, and we started digging and digging like bloody hell. And the place, they used to, the nickname was Stunk. They used to stunk the place. Anyway, what happened then, that during the night they come up with the anti-tank guns. I think they were, I think it was two pound anti-tank guns. Little guns, but they were effective. And they put them in position, and then we went after them, we started moving out and digging lines of fortifications again. Forming a perimeter inside the wood itself. So when, then it was patrol activity.
When they went in with the bayonets,
yeah.
Did you also personally go in with a bayonet yourself?
Yes, went in, yes. Yeah. In fact, I jumped. This, I remember seeing the Colonel Harris, and he was in a trench with another man, and he was Colonel of the Ulster Rifles, yeah. And I jumped over his trench, actually, running, and could see Germans running off out of the other side of the wood, you know. And there were quite a few, you know, hand-to-hand fighting. Anyway, they went and dug in about 600 yards outside at a single railway track. They dug in at the side of that, the Germans. And there was one area about 300 yards outside our perimeter. And it was a dugout. It was a German tank had been knocked out. And they got a machine gun under this tank. And Skip Skinner, he was the captain. We always call him Skip, but not to his face. he said to me, he said, I want you and another fella to go. He said, I'm going to try and knock that machine gun out tonight. So we studied the area, like what I've been then. We set off during night, we got right up to it, and I don't know if it was me or Skipper or other lad, we kicked it. They hadn't spotted us. We kicked a tin that must have been scattered off. The tank had been knocked out, and it skated and it didn't half rattle. Of course, it pulled the Germans on a full alert. So Skip said to me, "Give me that grenade, that was 36." So I said, "Here," he said. And he saw it, you see, and of course it went off. Next minute the whole front were afire, you know, little started firing. Anyway, we managed to get bigger dunny pumps on, and so we got back to the lines. And one or two lads who'd been, they got it by the in the trenches, but they got it. One was a lad called Little Dingabell, they looked after our dogs. And he'd been, they found him in the tanks following the morning. And there were quite a number of casualties. Then, Lieutenant Rinkle detailed me to take two men, and they were a knocked out German, British tank, a Churchill tank. And he said, I want you to go and see if there's anybody alive in that. And get them out. They were only about 70 yards from where the Germans were. So it meant a crawling job. So we crawled, and I got up to the doings, and there was a little trap door on the side, and it was on the blind side of the Germans. They couldn't see it because we crawled up. And I happened to get this trap door open. And as I opened the door, a great big cloud of flies rose out and went through the turret. I went in, and there was nobody alive. And the lads were in a terrible state. There was one man who just hung up and it, what was holding him up was his, he got his figure, his fingers on the trigger and just half of his body. And he was stood, just stood like that. And then all there was neither, no heads on or anything like that. So I wanted some identification. And then there were none on, but I saw a respirator. So I got this respirator and threw it out. So one of the lads, I said, keep that one, we'll take that back for identification. And then we crawled back into his own lines. And then we did another job.